David Fleischer is the founder and former director of the Los Angeles LGBTQ Center's Leadership Lab and the creator of the pioneering outreach approach called Deep Canvassing. Before the Leadership Lab, David was politically training programs at the Victory Fund and the National LGBTQ Plus Task Force. He is politically organized all over the country, advocating for LGBTQ Plus rights for decades. His work has been profiled in major publications such as The Atlantic and The New York Times. These days, David has an amazing Substack you really should check out. It's all about deep canvassing and its empirically proven ability to change hearts and minds. Dave Fleischer, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe.
So tell me what you're up to these days. What are you doing?
I'm doing two things. I'm writing about deep canvassing, trying to put it in human terms, because the truth is we just have too few people doing it. And if somebody lives where there's going to be a really close election, this approach potentially could make the difference between whether we have a terrible, tragic outcome in 2024 or whether our country makes it through. I'm not under any illusions that writing alone can save the world, but maybe writing will help more people decide that they really want to step up at a moment where we desperately need their help. The second thing I'm doing is spending time in some of the places where elections are sure to be close. I was just in Wisconsin a little over a week ago and visiting with different community leaders. They're wonderful. These groups are all very different. What I'm trying to do is see if I can encourage them to start earlier than they normally do. Because honestly, Joe, and I almost hate to say this aloud, but I feel like we've got to acknowledge the reality. The Republican Party has decided that its essence is disinformation, prejudice, division, appeals to fear. And as a result, we're about to see an election year like none we've seen in my lifetime, where chaos is going to be a frequent companion to any political activity, and where sadly, the Republican Party's willingness to legitimate violence is predictably going to make it very difficult if we wait and start our campaigns late. Because in the final 100 days, when a lot of people start, that's when the shit will hit the fan. And it's going to be very hard to stay focused and disciplined on having lovely conversations one-on-one with voters in that environment. So I want to help folks in Wisconsin and other states start much earlier, doing something that will really potentially affect the outcome, so that then we're able to sustain that even when things really get difficult.
So let's start, because you and I have talked about this before, but for those who haven't heard earlier seasons of this podcast, let's go into what is deep canvassing.
Sure. Deep canvassing is a set of best practices that give us a better chance to get somebody new on our side and voting with us. It's a way to overcome a lot of the misunderstanding that occurs when we start a conversation with somebody who's not just like us already.
So talk about how you got to deep canvassing sort of in the aftermath of Prop 8. Talk a little bit about how this started and how deep canvassing came about.
Sure. So Prop 8 was a vote in California in 2008 on whether or not LGBT couples could legally get married in California. And measures like this had been voted on in many other states around the country. We lost over 30 of these But when we lost this vote in California, liberal California, when we were favored to win and when every poll published in advance showed we were going to win, it really shook people up. LGBT people felt hurt. They didn't understand. Were they mistaken in thinking that prejudice had lessened over time? How is it that so many people voted against us, being able simply to marry the person we love? People in LA, who I was in touch with after the election, they really were doing their best, but they didn't know what to do. So there was a big march on a Mormon temple that led me to have a conversation with my friend, Daryl Cummings. And I said, Daryl, what are you doing? And he says, Dave, nobody knows what to do. They're just really upset. You got to come out here and start meeting with people. So I said, sure. And so in December of 2009, I came here, met with a bunch of people. Daryl was absolutely right. People did not know what to do. Felt very discouraged and angry. A bad combination for taking action and doing good thinking.
Yep.
And so after meeting with people, I had a couple of ideas that I thought might be helpful. One of them turned out to be the best idea I've ever had in my life, which is, since polls obviously had failed to capture how we were really doing with voters, and since our own common sense and experience about our neighbors also was not really helping us see our true situation, I thought, well, maybe we just need to go door to door in the neighborhoods where we got crushed and talk to the people who voted against us and ask them why they did that. And that is what led to the discovery of deep canvassing. And before it sounds like I'm bragging, I'm not, because honestly, Joe, I feel like a real dumbo. I should have thought of this idea 30 years earlier. I had lost plenty of campaigns prior, but it had never occurred to me to go talk to the people who voted against us and find out why. And as we began doing that, and as we began having conversations in a wide variety of Los Angeles neighborhoods, because quite honestly, we lost in a wide variety of Los Angeles neighborhoods, we started to not just learn the superficial answer to that question, the sort of face-saving answer that people would give us, but we got better at connecting with them so that they would talk more candidly about the feelings that were underneath. And we discovered that we were starting to be able to change people's minds when we reached that depth of a conversation. Not because we could somehow magically talk people into it. Anybody who thinks that's what persuasion looks like is really mistaken when it comes to anyone over the age of two. And so many voters are in that category, right? What really, it turns out, can happen is when we help people reflect on what really matters to them most, some of their political opinions don't really fit with how they really behave in their real life with real human beings. And especially, it doesn't reflect what they're like at their best selves and how they treat the people they love. And so when we would have a conversation with people and they offer this opinion that sounds terrible, but then as we talk about their life experience and our life experience, and especially what it's like that makes it possible for us to be in a relationship with somebody who loves us, then people started to notice, wow, these two things don't fit together. And so we asked them to consider which matters more. And it turns out people's real lived experience, they believe their real lived experience more than they believe their lousy opinions. So some of them change their mind.
All right. So, Dave, what do folks need to be successful at deep canvassing?
The first thing they need is to not try to guess what it'll be like to do it until they do it. Because people's expectations about what it would be like to talk with a stranger are very, very pessimistic. I don't know if you've ever read Nick Epley's book, Mindwise, but it's a brilliant look at how people misjudge and underestimate whether they're going to enjoy a conversation with somebody they don't know. So people who've never canvassed or never deep canvassed, they're afraid these conversations are going to be brutally difficult. They're not. They assume these are going to lead to an argument. They don't. The beauty of deep canvassing is that what we've learned really works is to offer radical respect, unqualified respect, and listen. And it turns out when you do that, people are really surprised and they don't really want to miss the opportunity we're giving them to talk about what really matters to them. So it turns out even when I talk with somebody who absolutely disagrees with me at the end of the conversation as well as at the beginning, it's pretty amicable. I mean, we've spent a significant amount of time seeking out people who voted for Donald Trump. We started doing it the day after he was inaugurated in 2017. And that required me to come out as a Clinton voter, right? Come out from that deep closet. Most of them had never met one. They thought it was kind of funny that I existed. Your audience is listening. They can't see that I'm an old, bald, gay, Jewish, short guy who does not look like Satan. I say that on a hunch. When we're talking to somebody and they see that we're human, and when we're interested in seeing their humanity, this is a beautiful experience. And then the nice reason that it pays off politically is some of these people change their mind. And when we deep canvass them and they change their minds stay changed. That's the really unusual thing about this tactic, because most attempts at political persuasion either don't persuade at all. So often they're never even directed towards people who are persuadable. But even when they are, they don't work. They just don't work. One-way communications telling people to change really struggle to change anybody. But even when they do, the effect is often evanescent. A TV ad, if it changes somebody's mind, 2 or 3 days later, they revert back to where they were. This is why in conventional campaigns, once a TV ad's on the air, you got to stay on the air until the end, because if you allowed 3 days to go by, people would erase whatever modest impression you've made. So, yeah, tell me what else you want to know.
I want to know lots of things. All right. So what does an organization need to be successful at deep canvassing? We talked about what an individual needs, but if an organization wants to do this, Dave, what are the resources they need? What's the kind of commitment we're talking about to be successful in deep canvassing?
Well, the funny thing is, it's not that hard. Almost every organization could do this. And in fact, even if no organization exists that wants to do it where you live, you could pull together a group of your friends and do it. There are a few things that you're going to need. You're going to need a team of people who want to do it, or at least try it. You're going to need to get some help with training so that you get to practice and start to integrate the principles of deep canvassing into how you have your conversations. You might need a little help with a script. And then you might need, I think it's helpful, to have access to the VAN or some voter file, because you really want to keep track of how you're doing. You really want to self-measure your effectiveness every single time you go out. And you want to do it in a way that's not going to give you an inflated sense of whether you're good yet. And then when you try this, you really need to try it for a little while. There's nothing in life where we do it the first time and we are terrific. I started learning how to play guitar when I was 60, Joe. I was not terrific. A year later, I was not terrific. Deep canvassing is a lot easier to learn than the guitar, because really what you need to do is you need to do it three times, where you've gone through training three times, each time right before you go out, and you need to be with your team to debrief what the experience was like for all of you after each of those canvases, immediately after, because that is really how you learn. And that's what helps people get over their nervousness. And so, honestly, anyone can initiate a deep canvassing project where they are. And they might be afraid, oh, this is going to be very small. It's just going to be me and a half dozen friends. But we've had congressional races in the last couple cycles decided by 100 votes, even as few as 6 votes. The truth is, one person and their friends could have changed the outcome just by talking to some people they don't know. And you can also deep canvass and talk to the people you do know, which some people find much scarier than talking to strangers, because Aunt Tilly will still be your aunt even after this election's over. But if you want to talk to people you do know, there's a whole discussion we can have about that. But the essence of success is tied up in doing this as a collective action, where a team of you do it. Because if it's just me going out canvassing and I have a lousy day, I just feel very demoralized at the end. But if I'm out with a team of 20 people, some people are going to have a lousy day, but many people are going to have a great day. And as we all share stories about what went right and what went wrong, I'm going to realize that I'm eventually going to have a good day and be effective at this. So that's the gist of it.
My first job in politics, my first paid job, was being a canvassing organizer for a congressional campaign in rural Indiana for a guy named Jim Johns. And we would knock on every door, and Jim came out of the purgs, and his instructions for canvassing was talk as long as you can until people shut the door, right? Have as long a conversation as you possibly could. So deep canvassing, before there was deep canvassing, right? This was 1990, long time ago. But to have these long conversations in the door, this was, 42% Democrat performance district. We don't hold districts that are that Republican anymore at all. And it was all about engagement, crews of people, local volunteers, though, having those conversations. And I do feel like, we have lost, for a long time, we're getting more back to it, but this need and this understanding that these conversations are important. So talk a little bit about, we're in a digital world, and there's this digital bubble that I think filters a lot of our conversations, right? How does digital hurt? Is there a way that digital can help in the conversations? Talk a little bit about that.
So I use digital tools every day, but I try to use them for what they're good for. It's the same way that if I need to change a light bulb, I don't use a hammer. There are better tools available, more likely to help me succeed at changing the light bulb. Hoping that a digital communication will change someone's mind is similar to hoping that the hammer will change the light bulb. It's not what the tool is good at. So when people ask me, is there an app for that? There isn't. Is there anything that you could post that would change somebody's mind? No, there isn't. Because the most important things that happen in a deep canvas conversation are the words that come out of the mouth of the other person. That's what they really remember, not our words. So the idea that what we say is going to change them, that is very, very rare. And so when people talk about American politics being polarized today, where people can't talk to each other, they're 100% wrong. In fact, the only hope for depolarizing is for people to talk to each other, ideally face to face. And we know this. We know this from our own life. You know, there's a reason that mail order brides really aren't a big part of love in America today. That's really the equivalent of a digital answer. You don't really know a person till you've been humble with them, curious about them, respectful towards them. None of that is communicable online.
Totally agree. So talk to me about what advice do you have for folks who are organizing in the field right now? And whether that's, you know, you name the issue, do you have general advice for folks that are out there engaging folks right now?
Oh, yeah.
Give me a couple.
Start today making a list of your friends who might want to do this with you. Start talking to them one-on-one, describing why you're concerned. Ask if they're concerned about the political situation. Describe what you want to try and see if they're open to it. One person at a time, you're going to find you've got a team of people who would be willing to try this with you. And then you're going to need to get together as a team and figure out, well, who are we going to ask to train us? Maybe there's a local group that already does this. There certainly are a few national groups that do this. I regularly do Zooms with readers of my Substack who want to learn about this, so they can even get training from me should they want that. Because ultimately, people are going to need training, and then they've got to try it right away. So if I was talking to a group of my friends about this, I'd say, look, can we make a commitment that for 60 days, we're going to make this a priority in our lives, even though that's going to disrupt our lives a little bit? It's not necessarily going to be our number one priority, but it's got to be a real priority because we have to do a lot of learning. We have to do a lot of practicing. And then we have to go out and do action and evaluate it. And we have to do it a few times so we get the hang of it. So that's what people should do now. And if somebody says to me, Dave, I live in Wisconsin. It's a little chilly here at the moment, and it's not going to warm up for a while. I say, yeah, I've been there. I know that. I grew up in the Midwest. So maybe if you're going to deep canvas, you're going to need to get access to an apartment building where people's doors open onto a hallway, so they'll be able to answer the door without freezing. Or maybe you're going to decide you're going to contact people you know. And you aren't going to do that door to door, probably. You're either going to do that in person or on the phone. That can be successful when you're talking to people you know, because they will take your phone call and you actually already have their phone number. So you can begin. And the real point I would say is begin as soon as you can stand it, because what if you love it? What if this ends up being the most satisfying, joyous political work you've ever done, which honestly has been my experience.
The canvassing also can start with long underwear and a really good pair of gloves, right? That you just have to get out there, right? And I think sometimes we create these barriers for ourselves that are not really barriers. And it may mean that you're going slower, that you're knocking on fewer doors, but those conversations are meaningful and you have to start.
Oh yeah. I mean, you're totally right, Joe. And really the question you've got to ask yourself when it's canvas day and it's raining is, okay, do I enjoy getting soaked? Not really. Can I protect myself so it's a little less painful? Yeah, I can. And what can I live with? Right. Getting wet or having this country come to an end as we know it. And I mean, if you really are scared of Trump and every day you're just expressing your anxiety, trying to decide whether you're going to be better off being an ostrich or a doom scroller, this is far better than either of those options.
My best days, my best engagement days as a canvasser when it was raining or snowing, right? And that was because people saw me at the door being human and there was empathy there, right? And there was empathy between me and the person at the door to say, wow, would you like to come in? Would you like to be on my porch? You know, and that empathy really matters. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges around building empathy these days, especially in a post-pandemic world? Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, empathy is kind of a tricky word because some people have it and some people don't. But you know what everybody's got is curiosity, if they're willing to develop it. And so I'm not the most empathetic guy. It does not come naturally to me. I am cognitive. I am so much better cognitively than I am using my emotional intelligence, honest to God. And yet, here I am finding that the best political work I've ever done in my life requires me to draw upon the little bit of emotional intelligence I've got, and the cognitive part of me can help because I know how to communicate respect to somebody, and I'm capable of being quiet and listening, especially when people are starting to talk about something that matters. So I don't know how to make the entire country more empathetic. But what I do know, and this, by the way, I did not invent, because it predates me, old as I am. One human being can affect another human being. That I know. And usually it happens when you find some common ground. And the phrase common ground sounds obvious, but it isn't. Because common ground, we tend to think it's where we are. They're going to come to us. Common ground is where they are. And so what we've really got to do is be curious enough about their real lived experience so we really see where they are and we see, oh my God, part of where they are, I'm really there too. Is that answering your question?
Oh, yeah. You know, one, I'm not asking you for a solution on empathy across the world, though I do say that I find you to be quite empathetic when I talk to you, but that's okay. I think part of also, I think maybe part of this too, is that I do find you to be a really good storyteller and that draws me in. And so I think you're right. Like sometimes we may confuse that for empathy, or we may confuse that engagement for empathy, but it's interesting. You want to talk a little bit about how important storytelling is in your work?
Sure. Before we persuade anybody, we have to connect with them. They have to want to be part of this interaction with us. And storytelling makes connection much more likely, especially if we're talking with somebody who has a different take on politics and voting than we do. Because if all we do is talk about our political opinions and we disagree, the conversation's over. Very rarely does it lead to a meeting of the minds. But when we tell a story about somebody we love and we make ourselves vulnerable, what the other person realizes as they're listening is we're not there to judge or shame them. And they realize maybe they trust us a little. And so when we ask them then to tell us a story about somebody they love, right, they might trust us enough to start to do that. The problem with storytelling is every story has multiple variations. I could tell you the 10-second version of a story or the 2-hour version of the story. The 10-second version, the headline version, is really not a story at all. It doesn't really get us anywhere. So the thing that's unusual about deep canvassing compared to conventional canvassing is you can't just have a 1-minute or 2-minute conversation with a non-voter, somebody who's missed the last 3 presidential elections, and change their mind. It's just not going to happen in 2 minutes. But in 15 minutes, there's enough time for us to tell a vulnerable story of ours and listen to a story of theirs, and for us to help them notice the common ground, not because we're the same, but because we do share something really important. That's what we end up discovering in the course of the conversation. And that's very exciting for people, because usually where the common ground is how we treat other people, what we think is right about how to go forth as a human being every day, especially with the people we love. And we have the advantage of having an election where the 2 opponents on the ballot are Donald Trump and love. That's what it's about. I wish I could say Joe Biden was going to have a big impact on this, but I don't think he will. But if people want to be a loving person, they know what love is. The best things that have happened in their life have been with people they love. They don't want to screw that up. And in fact, what they know about themselves is they are the best version of themselves when they are treating people the way they treat the people they love. And voting is just one more gift we can give the people we love. So storytelling gets us there. And I don't know anything else that does.
So one of the things I've always been impressed with you and your work is that you've been very open to allowing testing and evaluation into the programs that you've run. Can you talk about a little bit about why that's so important and why other people should allow evaluation of their programs?
You know, the funny thing is, all of us know how crucial measurement is for anything we really care about. I don't know of anybody who has a retirement account and they're not interested in the measurement of how much money is in it. I've just not met that person. The truth is, when things really matter, we always measure them. So in politics, if we're not going to measure, we're really saying this isn't important. And I don't know why people are content doing a little of this and a little of that, which is what I would say most political work amounts to. Because if they measured at all, they would realize that's the biggest mistake they can make. They've got to do something repeatedly so they're good at it, so they get a measurable result. So the academics and institutions that are willing to help measure and will independently of us measure whether we're doing a good job, they're like our best friends. I don't owe anybody a bigger debt in my life than David Brockman and Josh Calla, who measured our deep canvassing work for real in a very rigorous way. That was a gigantic pain in the ass. But how else would we know what we're really getting done?
Yeah. All right. So I'm a fan of your Substack. You write quite a bit, which, you know, as someone who, with the help of Elizabeth and my team, we've been blogging steadily at least once a week since 2013. So we're big fans of writing about what we do and what we know. You got a favorite thing you've written lately? Because you publish every couple weeks at this point. So if somebody was going to go on the Substack today asking for a friend and look and say, hey, here's one of your favorite things that you've written, what would it be?
Well, the most practical one piece, if you were going to pick one post, would be to read the one about how to help a non-voter decide they're going to vote. Because in this country, a third of the eligible voters didn't vote for president in the last presidential election. And in fact, at least a third of all eligible voters in this country have failed to vote for president in every presidential election for the last 100 years. So, that means some of the people we know aren't voting, even if they agree with us and feel strongly about how terrible Donald Trump is, they're not voting. And so the simplest, easiest conversations you could begin with would be to talk to some of your friends who don't vote, deep canvass them and help them reconsider. So there's one piece specifically on this. There's also another piece specifically on how to talk to people you know who aren't voting. So maybe those are the two to start with, but they're short pieces.
Yeah.
So if you like one, maybe you'll read another, maybe you won't.
Yeah. So anything else that you're reading, listening to these days that inspires you?
Yeah. I just finished Rachel Maddow's new book about the pro-Nazi movement to keep the U.S. out of World War II or to get the U.S. to align with Hitler. The book really is a piece of forgotten history that we ought not to forget, because the parallels to the moment we're in are really striking. But if that's feeling a little too dark for people, you know, if somebody told me they wanted to be a more empathetic person, what I would really say to them is read Ann Patchett. And in fact, specifically, read her essays. She has two books that collect her essays. And specifically, there's an essay in one of the books. It's the last one in the book. It's a novella in length, but it's about her relationship with a nun who was her teacher in first, second, and third grade, and with whom she has remained friends over the course of her whole life. Amazing. Because it's going to really remind any of us that there are moments when all of us need help. Somebody who isn't voting, they might not be happy with it, but they're not going to change a habit without somebody helping them. And what Ann Patchett's body of work is about is how people can help each other. And she's such a stunning writer. It doesn't feel preachy in any way. You're familiar with her work, it looks
like. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. I have not read the essays, but I should, and I will look at it. Seems great. So you're going to get a reader out of me for sure to look at that. But Dave, thank you for the discussion. If folks want to get a hold of you, if they want to learn more about deep canvassing, where do they go? How do they find you?
If they go to my Substack, which is pretty easy to find, maybe, Joe, you'd be able to print on the screen the link.
It'll be in the show notes. Don't you worry.
We Terrific. Will,
yeah, put it out there.
And then in the basic info that I have is actually an email address specifically for Substack readers to reach me directly. I respond to every single email I get, or at least have done so far. If this makes sense to somebody listening, or if they want to know more, I want to help.
Amazing. Well, Dave, thank you. It's been great having you on the show again, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
How to Win a Campaign is Joe Fold, Martin Diego Garcia, Elizabeth Rowe, Phoebe Retta, Samantha Sondick, and Lauren Odom. Music by Daniel Pinto. Audio editing by Christopher Lang. Special thanks to the team at the Campaign Workshop. Please review, like, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.